Pals O' Mine. A couple of books to share with you. The Man Who Walked Away by Maud Casey is set in France in the 1880s. The man, Albert, is a patient who walks and walks, doesn't know how he arrived, but is always in search of astonishment. The doctor is a psychiatrist trying to solve the patient's mental issue and discovers a few parallels of his own life. Casey writes eloquently and clearly, such as, "Albert tries to catch the memory by the tail before it trails off into darkness." Boy, can I relate to that. I love how eloquently written books evoke eloquently written reviews, such as this one by Christine Shute, author of Prosperous Friends. Quote, "Starts with a wind, the poet's element, that blows over, through, and past all, transporting us, as great art will, to the wonderment of being in the world, or in Albert's case, not in the world, only in the vase of the asylum, with its benign director and staff, can Albert rest, find love, he hopes, and a history. Casey's novel, with its accounts of the asylum's correctives to the anguish of erasure, walks in nature and the song of Nurse Anne's voice, is an axe to the ice-encased heart, musically wrought, deeply affecting, wise and consolatory." End quote. Humor is sprinkled in the book, here and there, such as this passage. The director, his face red with the excitement of nature, asks them to close their eyes as he tells them about the coined Greek word for beauty that contains the word for hour. "Close your eyes and listen," says the director. "Yes," Elizabeth says. "How interested I was the first time you told us this story." That's The Man Who Walked Away by Maud Casey. Second book, Forgotten Aviator, The Adventures of Royal Leonard. It's a biography of Mr. Leonard, written by Barry S. Martin. Leonard wrote his autobiography in 1941, I Flew for China. After reading that book, Martin became intrigued by the pilot's adventurous life before and after his autobiography, and spent 20 years researching and conducting interviews. The result is the telling of a life story which truly is stranger than fiction. I had an opportunity to speak with Barry Martin, and rather than me providing you the highlights of the book and Leonard's strange but true life, I'll let Martin do that. So you worked on this book for a long time.
20 years.
2 decades, holy
moly.
That's
right. It's the kind of a book that an academic could not do because he would not get tenure. Or a professional writer could not do because it would take too long to get a paycheck. So I had read books over the years where an individual worked a long time on a project outside his regular work. And I always thought I'd like to do something like that, and the opportunity arose.
Now, how did you first come across Leonard's name?
My wife and I won a trip to China in 1988.
And how did that come about?
I filled out a coupon in an airline magazine requesting certain travel literature, and it asked for your age group. After that, I got a letter from Grand Circle Travel, which is a major travel agency. And at that time, it was catering to retirees, but it wanted to start catering to people in their 50s, which was my classification. So next, I got a letter from Grand Circle Travel, and it said, if you will complete a 20-page travel questionnaire, you will be one of something like 2,000 people who have a chance to win a trip to China, 3 weeks, all expenses paid. Now, my wife had won a trip to Hawaii, and she'd also won a lifetime supply of pillows and towels and stuff like that. So she was willing to fill out the questionnaire, which the odds, that's not bad. Actually, there were two trips. And so you've got a 1 in 1,000 chance, actually. So next I get a phone call, and somebody says, this is Grand Circle Travel. You've won a trip to China. Congratulations. And I almost hung up, but I said, wonderful. And they said, we'd like information. You need a visa. So I said, fine. And then time is getting short to go, and I went in to see my boss. I didn't have enough accumulated
vacation time.
Kind of embarrassed because maybe this was going to happen, maybe it wouldn't. Did happen. It was a wonderful tour. 3 weeks, there were only 15 people on the tour. It was terrific. Just before Tiananmen Square happened in 1988. So I got back, and I wanted to find out about Americans who'd done things in China. Went down to the old Beers bookstore in downtown Sacramento. I found two books. One by Royal Leonard, I Flew for China, and the other, a book entitled Shanghai Lawyer. And I bought them both, and I said, well, maybe this is something I could fulfill my ambition with. I contacted the Smithsonian Aviation Museum. Leonard's book came out in 1942, and I was trying to find out, what did he do in World War II? Was he still alive? And the Smithsonian did not have any information about him. He kind of disappeared. So on a business trip, I was at Burbank Airport. I knew Leonard had lived in that area. I looked in the phone book, and there was listing for Royal S. Leonard. The Royal Leonard that I wrote about did not have a middle name or a middle initial. So I called, and a lady answered, and it turned out to be Royal Leonard's ex-wife, who in the late 30s, twice for a one-year period of time, had been over in Hong Kong and China with him. So that got me going. That was the start of the 20 years.
So that must have been interesting for her, on her side, that someone was expressing interest after all this time.
She said that one author had indicated an interest, but it was just too big a project in terms of time. Not that he wasn't capable of it, and he'd let it drop.
Well, good for you.
Yeah.
Does Leonard have children? Did he have?
He has a son, Royal S. Leonard.
So that was the S, was the child. Then.
Right.
Okay.
I met with them, and it turned out that Leonard's, I'll call her first wife, Maxine, when she'd been in China those 2 1-year periods of time, one from late 38 to late 39 and the other from mid 40 to mid 41, once or twice a week wrote a letter to her mother about what was going on, and kept carbon copies. And Royal Leonard did the same thing. He wrote a lot of letters to his mother, his brother, his sister, one of his best friends, and he kept carbon copies. So a big part of my project, when I would go down to LA on a business trip, would be to meet Royal S. and Xerox a whole bunch more of letters. So I was able to get a lot of detail that you usually aren't able to find. I mean, I wasn't even expecting it.
So how do you think that carbon copying their letters came about? What was the impetus for doing that, or the motivation for doing that, I should say?
I know that he would basically send the same letter 2 or 3 people. There was a problem. Would the mail get out of China and get to the United States in the late 1930s leading up to Pearl Harbor? And, you know, he wasn't sure any of them would get out.
So what were you doing in the meantime for occupation or career?
I was a lawyer for the Air Resources Board here in Sacramento, and the Air Resources Board has their vehicular facility, where they deal with car regulation, air pollution control, is down in El Monte. So I would get up, take the early plane to L.A., and then in the late afternoon, most people in my position would go straight to the airport, catch a 6 or 7 o'clock plane home. I would catch the 10 o'clock and used the 2 or 3 hours to do a little work on my hobby.
Your hobby probably expanded quite a bit because of the story, not just Leonard's story, but just pieces of history that probably came your way, crossed your path.
That's true. Leonard's book, I Flew for China, published in 1942, covered the time from late 1936 until late 1941. And there's just about a 10-page preface, which kind of recited a little bit of what he had been doing. And that's where I dug into it, and I found out all kinds of things. He had flown the actual plane that Wiley Post and Will Rogers, the famous columnist and movie actor, in fact, the most popular Hollywood actor in terms of gross receipts at the time he died. Leonard had flown that plane and had a theory which was different than any other your theories about why Wiley Post and Will Rogers crashed in a plane in Alaska in 1935. He was in the Bendix race, which was the Kentucky Derby of American aviation racing in the 30s. The race went from Burbank to Cleveland. He flew a GB, which was the most dangerous racing plane of its time. Five were built for racing, six pilots died trying to fly them. He was one of the founders of the Airline Pilots Association, the present-day Pilots Union. He was mixed up in all kinds of things. The first three or four chapters of the book are about what he did before he went to China.
For example?
The first chapter deals with he was trained at Brooks and Kelly Field in San Antonio, Texas, in the late 20s. That was called the West Point of the Air. We didn't have our Air Force Academy like we do now. And the Army had learned a lesson from World War I. It didn't have any pilots to speak of trained for World War I, so they were trying to develop a cadre of trained pilots. He was third in his class to solo, and then the best of the group were put into the fighter pilot group, and he was the captain of the fighter pilot group. So he did very well in that type of training. And then he was a Rocky Mountain mail pilot from mid-1928 to mid-1929, flying the airmail at night from Cheyenne down through Denver, Colorado Springs to Pueblo and back with very primitive instruments. He and the other pilot, they switched days. One would fly one day, the other the next. Completed 98% of their scheduled flights, which is really incredible. People have flown in and out of Denver and seen the weather there, and these guys were flying these little Stearmans, which are like these crop dusters that you see around here in the Sacramento Valley. And then he went to work for the predecessor to TWA. He was one of their first passenger pilots. He was involved in what is called the McRobertson race between London and Australia. In the mid-30s, there was no airline passenger service between England and Australia. So this race was designed to publicize things and try to get the aviation people
interested. Promotional event.
Yeah. And then he flew, I mentioned, in the Bendix race. He flew a GB, the very dangerous plane. He was lucky. He survived. He had engine problems halfway across the country and was able to make an emergency landing.
So you are probably a semi-expert on aviation. For that time period, anyway. I said
airlines that he flew for and planes that he flew.
So what really surprised you the most about the flying instruments that were available at that time?
Well, when they were flying the mail in the 1920s, the compasses were affected by magnetic influences. They were unreliable. Their big problem was if you got into fog and you didn't know where the horizon was and you didn't know what was up and what was down, the altimeters only measured to the nearest 50 or 100 feet. So if you came down and the ceiling was almost on the ground, you didn't have a lot of room to spare. And then the bank and turn indicator, which would show you're turning, but not whether your wings were level for landing. There was no ground-to-air radio. So these guys would get up in the fog and just spin around and go into stalls and crashed. A lot of pilots lost their lives flying the mail in the 1920s. And in the 1930s, the major airlines were shut down for a while by the federal government, and the Army tried to fly the mail. And these are professional pilots with more advanced instruments. Several of them died flying the mail over about a month-long period. The problem was getting it through. You know, they were supposed to get through and meet another plane or meet a train or something. And some of them said, that's my job, and they went out and did it.
Just matter of fact, and they knew the odds and the risks.
They knew the odds, yeah.
Have you been able to see any of these type of planes in person?
Yes. Royal Leonard flew, a Stearman biplane. And there's an example of that in the Aviation Museum up in Seattle, Washington. The GB, there's one, well, there have been several built since, the replicas. I've seen one of those flown once, and it's just incredible. It's like watching a little bomb go through it. It's got stubby little wings. It just, you just wonder, how could it fly?
And why would someone voluntarily sit in it and fly it?
To win a race, to win the prestige race. Jimmy Doolittle was one of our most famous pilots. He was probably the most successful racing pilot in the 30s. He flew a GB, and the last time he got out of it and said, I never did fly that son of a bitch, and I'm never going to fly one again.
Done.
Right.
So what kind of childhood did Leonard have that you think may have influenced him into this area of his life that he pursued?
He had tremendous balance. He taught himself to walk a typewriter, which I thought was exceptional. And the pilots who knew him during World War II commented how he'd be sitting on a chair like you're seated in, and he could balance the chair on the two back legs. Two front legs would be tipped up. He also had exceptional vision. He took a test to determine whether he'd get into one of the Navy programs. Two stakes were set foot or so apart, several 100 or 200 yards away from him. He could tell which one was closest and how far apart better than most people who took that test. Those were his two physical abilities. He was very disciplined. He taught himself to walk the tight wire first by walking on a metal pipe like a handrail, and then just methodically in his backyard worked until he was up on a wire maybe 7 or 8 feet high and 50 feet long. And then he performed at PTA concert. Also, physically, he had tremendously strong legs. I don't know what that had to do with flying, but he graduated from high school in Waco, Texas. He rode a bike 1,400 miles to the University of Wisconsin in Madison and worked along the way to earn money.
So what was his upbringing like as far as his parents?
Poor. His father could not make it. They went to Texas about 1910, Waco, tried to make it on a small farm. He couldn't, and then they moved into town, and the father had various jobs. The mother was the one that really pushed the kids. The other brother graduated from college, and so did the sister, which is pretty amazing.
Like the phoenix, almost. You know, there's different aspects of the phoenix. It's not always ashes, but it's still struggling and flying out of what seems to be negative or blocks of success.
He was in this army training program for pilots. There were like three enlisted men. He had 2 years of college, but he enlisted to get into the flying program. So there were like three enlisted men and 155 other guys who were either officers or college graduates. And then that was the same situation when he got into the advanced program. He was a loner, and he stood up to management 2 or 3 times, which cost him a job. When he was with Airline Pilots Association in the 30s, he was both flying passenger planes, and there were planes that just flew the mail still. And this is about 34, 35. And he got involved in negotiations with the vice president who actually was in charge of TWA, a man named Jack Fry. The problem was the safety of the mail planes. The one that Will Rogers and Wiley Post crashed in was a Lockheed Orion. And there had been a crash of a TWA pilot in Kansas City where the pilot took off, banked to the right, and the engine shut off. Plane nosed into the river and the pilot was killed. Leonard recreated this accident. He went up where he was high enough so he shut off the engine. He could get out of the problem. And he discovered, and this is what he thought happened to Wiley Post in Alaska. There was a lever that raised the wings on the back, and you do this, and there were two handles here right under the elbow, which connected to the spark plugs. And if you hit them, you could turn off the spark plugs, and then the engine turned off. And that's what he thought caused the accident up in Alaska, where Wiley Post and Will Rogers were lost in Alaska. They landed in this lagoon, asked the Eskimos which way to where they wanted to go, took off, banked to the right, and nosed right into the lagoon, and both Will Rogers and Wiley Post were killed. So, he presented that information to the management. They didn't like that too much. And this was the Depression, see, and the airline didn't have the money to buy new planes, which they did, but not right away. He also lost a paternity suit, which is another story. The paternity suit involved this vice president of TWA, Anne Royal Leonard. The woman was the personal secretary of the vice president of TWA, Jack Fry. The woman and Fry said that Royal was responsible, and Royal thought that Mr. Fry was responsible. Royal was single. Mr. Fry was married. The woman said that she'd had two different liaisons with Royal. His logbook showed he wasn't in the city where she claimed this happened. But the judge, there was a paternity case down in Los Angeles, and it was kind of, you know, second section, front page news for the week, what was going on in the trial between the racing pilot and the boss's secretary. The judge decided he was the father. So that's when he went to China.
See ya.
Yeah, he did pay off all the support obligation, but he was fired. Well, actually, he had been given leave to fly in this London to Australia case, a race. Leonard said that one of the lower management said he could stay longer. The vice president, Fry, said, no, you overstayed your leave. Goodbye. Plus, you were a union guy. Goodbye. Plus, you didn't marry my secretary. Goodbye.
Strike, strike, strike.
Right. He tended to get in situations, yeah.
So what did you learn about him, his attitude and perspective, versus those, like, say, Chuck Yeager? Did you find similarities of pilots who are testing pilots? I don't know if you call them. Because they were trying new aviation feats and different planes, test pilots of sorts, like the one you said, the little stubby thing.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting that you bring up Chuck Yeager, because both Chuck Yeager and Royal Leonard had relationships with Jackie Cochran, probably the most famous aviatrix ever. She was the first woman to fly faster than the speed of sound. And when she did that, Yeager was kind of flying off to the side. She was married to a gentleman who was the principal owner of Convair, which was an automobile airplane manufacturer, among other things. And Leonard was pioneer in celestial navigation, like the sailors do on the ocean. This was new in the mid-30s, and he was involved in it, and he'd written an article for one of the aviation magazines. And Jackie Cochran had 2 years flying experience. She had this close friend, Floyd Odlum, owned Convair later on, who was married, but they were very close, and he was financing her. She wanted to fly in the London to Australia race. She only had 2 years flying experience. So she, with Odlum's money, hired Royal Leonard and another pilot to be her co-pilots. And they worked with her on celestial navigation. And navigation was one of her big problems, like Amelia Earhart. She had to have a navigator with her. So Leonard was close to Jackie Cochran at the beginning of her aviation career, like Chuck Yeager was at the end. To directly answer your question, I think Royal Leonard should have been a test pilot, but they didn't have test pilots in the 30s. For example, the DC-2 and DC-3, just two of the greatest, most famous aircraft of all time. There was a DC-1, which was the first one where they saw if everything worked. The test work was done by TWA pilots. Leonard was one of the pilots who flew the DC-1 and checked it out to see if the cockpit was compatible to taking celestial navigation observations. That was one of his problems. He knew too much about the planes, and he told the airline management about it.
But different kind of whistleblower.
Yeah. He thought pilot safety came first. Flying the hump was very dangerous, which Leonard did at the end of his career between northeastern India and western China around the Himalayas. And they flew at night in bad weather, because if they flew too far away from the mountains, they would be within the range of the Japanese fighters down in Burma. So, I mean, you know, they were between the devil and the deep blue sea. Leonard had some problems with management and some of their maintenance techniques on the planes, which didn't endear him.
Self-preservation issues, I'm sure, came up as well, not just other pilots.
Yeah, although he never seemed to turn down any of these flights. He had conflicts with Jack Fry, who was the guy who built TWA. He had conflicts with Juan Tripp, who built Pan Am. And he had conflicts with Mr. Bond, who was the American executive in charge of China National Aviation Corporation when that airline was flying over the hump. So that's an interesting... He was definitely an independent thing.
And he's in the midst of
into everything. I mean,
he's like Pigpen.
Now, on a positive side, he was a very close associate of Claire Chennault. Claire Chennault is our flying tiger. hero from World War II. At the start of World War II, the Japanese were whipping us badly. And before Pearl Harbor, Clara Chennault had started this group called the Flying Tigers. They were training in Burma. Fighter pilots from our Navy, Marine, and Army were recruited to go over there and fly with them. And they shot down a lot of Japanese planes. This is all before Pearl Harbor in December 41. Leonard goes back to knowing Chennault from when Leonard was training in San Antonio. And Chennault was what they called the checkout pilot. If a pilot's principal instructor thought the guy should be kicked out of the program, Chennault would give the guy his final checkout. And if Chennault thought he had the makings of a pilot, the guy continued in the program. Leonard didn't have any problems that way. In 1937, Madame Chiang Kai-shek brought Chennault over to China to try to fix up the Chinese Air Force, which was in pretty bad shape. And at first, he roomed with Leonard, who was already a pilot over there working for China National Aviation Corporation at that time. And Chennault hired Leonard to train Chinese Air Force bomber pilots in the fall of 1937. And then we jump up to late 1941. The Flying Tigers were very successful, but they only had fighters. And it had been decided that the Flying Tigers should have a bomber squad. So Chennault and Madame Chiang Kai-shek selected Leonard to be the head of that. He was on a ship coming back from Hong Kong when Pearl Harbor occurred. He was supposed to go to Burbank, to the Lockheed plant, where there was a bunch of bombers ready to fly back to China for Chennault's Flying Tigers. But because of Pearl Harbor, things changed, and the Flying Tigers never got bombers, and they were disbanded in July 1942, and those who wanted to go into the Army Air Corps did, and those who didn't did other things. Some of them went with the China National Aviation Corporation and flew for a civilian airline during World War II.
So how old was Mr. Leonard when he passed?
He died in 1962. He was 57. Another example, he's very loyal to Chennault. He's very loyal to Jackie Cochran. Leonard's first job in China in late 1936 was as a pilot for the young marshal who was the warlord in Manchuria. And in late 1936, the communists were up near Xi'an. That's where those big figures have been uncovered, terracotta, life-size soldiers and so on. Chiang Kai-shek had built up enough strength where he thought he was just about ready to eliminate the Chinese Communist Army. Well, there was a split in China. The Japanese had occupied Manchuria and three provinces in northeastern China. Most Chinese wanted to get rid of the Japanese, drive them out. Chiang wanted to get rid of the communists. Well, the young marshal, for whom Leonard was working, kidnapped Chiang Kai-shek, and they forced him to change his policy. After Chiang agreed to change his policy, the young marshal surrendered himself to Chiang, and Leonard was out of a job. So then he went to work for Chiang Kai-shek. He got into all kinds of things.
So you said he had one son, Barry S.
He had one son born Royal in 1944 or 1945.
The one that he disputed, but still...
No. They were married. That was the woman who wrote the letters.
So did he ever meet later the son that he... the paternity suit that he had fought?
That child was developmentally disabled and died.
That's sad.
Yeah. Leonard paid off all the... monthly support obligation that the court had ordered.
But he had the one with the middle initial that you saw
right
in the phone book.
Who's still living down in the Los Angeles area.
So he has, did he have children as well?
And Royal S. married a little later. His children are college age now. Two children, boy and a girl.
But they are descendants of the original Royal.
That's definitely, yeah.
So do you think that they learned from your book? There's probably aspects they weren't aware of.
Right.
That's a wonderful gift that you provided for them.
Royal S. one time said that he would never want to have me as an investigator turned around. Royal S. brought his son up to meet with Moon Chin. He's a Chinese-American. He's 101 years old. He flew Jimmy Doolittle out of China after the Doolittle bombing raid on Tokyo in the spring of 1942. Royal S. brought his son up to the Bay Area to talk to Moon Chin for a high school history project. Got a very good grade.
I bet he did.
Yeah.
Wow, that's impressive.
Yeah.
What attributes of Royal Leonard's that you discovered that you wish that you had in your own life?
Adventure? This man had so many adventures. I would be pleased to be able to talk about just one of them at the dinner table. But he was involved in all these situations. He basically took a lot of calculated risks and survived. He was involved in many historically important events in China, not only the kidnapping in Xi'an of Chiang Kai-shek. He gave Zhou Enlai his first plane ride. Zhou Enlai was the East Communist political commissar at that time and later succeeded Mao Zedong as the head of the Chinese government. Leonard went out and picked him up in the hills and brought him back in when the negotiations were taking place over what was going to be done with Chiang Kai-shek and what Chiang Kai-shek was going to do about the Japanese. And then Leonard, the rape of Nanking, famous in Chinese history, the Japanese came into Nanking, which was one of the principal cities, and tens of thousands of crimes committed. Leonard made the last flight of a commercial airplane out of Nanking before that happened. The Chinese kept moving west. The Japanese kept pushing them west. Nanking was their capital. Then they went to Hangzhou, and Leonard was one of three or four pilots who evacuated Chinese government personnel under the Japanese guns. And from there, they went to Chongqing in way west China. That's where they were during the war. When he was back here, this is probably what I would have liked to have done most. After he arrived back in the United States in December 1941, right after Pearl Harbor, he got a call from Washington, D.C., from Army Intelligence. He didn't realize that Army Intelligence was basically interested in getting information on Chinese landing fields because Doolittle, when he bombed Tokyo, he took off from an aircraft carrier. These were bombers. A lot of people didn't think they could do it. They took off with bombers, they bombed, and then they were headed for China. And none of them actually made it to China. They bailed out in the sea, or one of the planes ended up in Russia. But the Army wanted information about Chinese landing fields. And Leonard was probably knew more about Chinese landing fields than any other American, because in the spring of 1941, he'd taken a U.S. delegation to look at Chinese landing fields, both existing and potential. So he was called back to Washington. At this time, our Army transport system was in total disarray. The airlines were fighting to try to get that themselves. By that, I mean flying supplies to Europe and Africa. China National Aviation Corporation was a subsidiary of Pan Am, and the president of Pan Am talked to Leonard and said, "We don't want you talking to the Army until we finish our negotiations over what we are going to do." And Leonard didn't think that was too patriotic. So he went and he talked with General Dwight Eisenhower, who was at that time head of the War Plans Division for the Far East. This was before Marshall picked him to be in charge in Europe. And he had an hour or so meeting with Eisenhower and a few other high-ranking officers and told him about the aviation situation in China. And then he comes back to Los Angeles for a little R&R, and he gets another call. "Would you please come up to Alameda Island? Jimmy Doolittle wanted to talk." So he talked to Doolittle about the Chinese landing fields. So, I mean, he just touching on all kinds of things. You won't see him mentioned in an Eisenhower biography. You won't see him mentioned in a Doolittle biography. You'll see him mentioned in some Chennault biography. Zelig, the biography of Ronald Reagan, where he had the historian in the White House all these years and they never could figure him out. So I guess he used the vehicle of a Zelig-like character who was there.
Third party.
Yeah, but imaginary in that case.
Yeah.
Yeah.
When he passed away at 57, how was he spending his life during that time?
After World War II, he was an aviation consultant in Hong Kong. Actually, Kai Tak Airport is in Kowloon, which is on the mainland. Hong Kong's an island out in the bay. One tremendously interesting story about Leonard. This is documented from other letters that I found down at the Hoover Institution at Stanford University. When the young Marshall in January 1937 surrendered himself to Chiang Kai-shek because he believed he'd disobeyed his leader and he had to do what the leader decided, he was sentenced to 10 years prison. In 1947, he was supposed to be released. Chiang Kai-shek never released him as long as he was alive. Our attaché, military attaché in Manchuria and some other people in the State Department thought that the young marshal was a potential Chinese leader other than the nationalist Chiang Kai-shek, who he went with, or the communist Mao Zedong. The young marshal had been a very progressive leader in Manchuria and was a fairly worldly man. Well, when the Chinese communists drove the nationalists out of China in 1949, Chiang Kai-shek, of course, went to Formosa, or Taiwan, as it's called, and he took the young marshal with him. Leonard is still advocating to a congressman from Texas that we actually were trying to get rid of Chiang Kai-shek. He was tremendously unpopular on Formosa. Formosa had been held by the Japanese since 1895 until 1945. So the Chinese nationalists were like almost another invader coming in, and there were some pretty brutal things done. We were looking for an alternative leader. Well, Leonard decides, what if I could free the young marshal, who Chiang Kai-shek had built a house for him and everything, and the head of the young marshal's guard had been a young lieutenant. By this time, he's a brigadier general. He's been guarding the young marshal. So Leonard comes up with these two wild schemes that are like out of a movie to try to spring him, and he was going to fly him. It's only 300 miles or so to the Philippines in a small plane. He had two different plans, but it never happened. The Korean War broke out in June 1950. Leonard, after that, came back to the United States. Mainly was involved in, he built a few apartment houses. That's another story. These guys that flew the hump came back rich. Smuggling. Smuggling was one thing. Currency exchange was another. If you could bring in a gold bar to China, you'd get all kinds of money for it. So there were a couple of airlines, Cathay Pacific, I think, is one. Flying Tigers Airline, the Freight Line, which is now FedEx. These were founded by, and there was another one, that were founded by former hump pilots that returned quite wealthy.
Interesting.
From that. So Leonard had some money. He tried these different businesses. He even had a trucking company one year working on one of the highways up in the Sierras. He had a magnesium foundry, but mostly he invested in some apartments.
He doesn't seem like the kind of person who could just hang out on a couch and watch TV.
No. As an aside, he did take movies. He remarried. He divorced the woman who spent some time in China with him. He was over in the Orient more than he was at home. So they had divorced, and he remarried, and his widow had his movies. One of the movies, very few Americans were entertained by Chiang Kai-shek. One of them is of a party thrown by Chiang Kai-shek. It's like in the backyard. Yard in some California suburb, you know, and you're there taking movies of everybody.
Wow.
There. He left a tremendous record. The problem was digging it out.
Knowing where the records are located.
Well, you can't even imagine them. You can't even imagine all
these
letters.
You don't know they existed, yeah.
There must be 20 inches high stack of letters.
How fun.
Yeah. So the big part was sorting out. And in writing the book, his adventures as a Rocky Mountain pilot are really quite incredible, but I only do about half a chapter on that. If this were a biography of Lindbergh, it would be at least 500 pages, because people want to know everything about it, and every flight that anything happened on. With Leonard, the book's only about 177 pages of text, and that's because I left quite a bit out. Like, he's flying one night from Cheyenne from Denver to China or back. I can't really tell from the letter. And he gets in a little dogfight with an eagle. You know, there's all kinds of stuff, but...
With an actual eagle?
He thought it was. He thought he was going after a buzzard. He was from Texas. It's interesting in these letters that he wrote to his brother in the late 20s, and the brother kept all these letters. That's a shoebox full of letters of Leonard's life. And how, as a Texas boy, he's flying between Denver and Cheyenne, and at first they're mountains, and then they become hills, because those aren't the Rocky Mountains. He just described things in detail, and he was a pretty good writer. His book is very readable. I Flew for China, which got me started on this, trying to find out what else happened to him. He had an editor named Richard Hubler, who wrote the first campaign biography for Ronald Reagan. When I wrote this book, I felt most people are going to be more interested in what he did in China with all these important people. So I think I've only got like four chapters before he went to China. And then the rest is about his adventures over there. Women were interested in him because if you get him started, first of all, you'd probably see him in a pilot's outfit. Then if he started telling you his stories, you'd have to be impressed. One of the longtime China pilots, a man named Felix Smith, who wrote a book about his experience over there called China Pilot, said if Royal's story were told in a novel, nobody would believe it all could have happened to one man. And I think that's true. That's why I footnote as extensively as I did, because some of these things just sound like, how could that have happened?
So if you could sum it up in a sentence or two about his character and how inspirational he could be to others that are loners, don't feel maybe that they're recognized, what suggestions would you have?
He's a man who stood up for what he believed was right. Primarily, it was either safety or patriotism. He was blacklisted, essentially, by American Airlines after World War II because of his difficulties with TWA's top management and Pan Am's top management. If you're going to stick up and go against the powers that be, you've got to be willing to take the consequences, would be my advice. Because many people just kind of, yeah, that was Royal. Nobody else would have taken on Juan Tripp or Jack Fry, who are major figures in American aviation history.
But he stuck to his principles.
That's right. That's the way my wife likes.
Me too, Ollie.
Okay.
In author Daniel Ford's review of the book, he noted that Royal Leonard seems to have fallen on the wrong side of the line between genius and lunacy. Again, that's Forgotten Aviator, The Adventures of Royal Leonard by Barry S. Martin. Available on Amazon, Barnes & Noble, and Apple's iBookstore. By the way, Martin is currently working on the biography of legendary basketball player Bob Davies, who invented the behind-the-back dribble and pass. Stay tuned! In my ongoing celebration of the 150th anniversary of the National Park System, I'm heading over to Missouri. Ozark National Scenic Riverways is the first national park area to protect a river system. Upon signing the Wild and Scenic Rivers Act in 1968, President Lyndon Johnson said, "An unspoiled river is a very rare thing in this nation today. Their flow and vitality have been harnessed by dams, and too often they have been turned into open sewers by communities and by industries. It makes us all very fearful that all rivers will go this way unless somebody acts now to try to balance our river development." The park stretches for about 134 miles along both the Jack's Fork and current spring-fed rivers. Blue Spring is a popular name in Missouri, and the park has two of them. The larger of the two is on the Current River and called Spring of the Summer Sky by Native Americans. One of the deepest in the United States, it is 300 feet deep, resulting in a startling, vivid blue. There are caves and sinkholes in the park. The best-known shut-in in the park is the Ozark National Scenic Riverway's Rocky Falls. Shut-in is an Ozark term for small, canyon-like areas where water and rock struggle. Alley Mills was built in 1894, when wooden water wheels were already obsolete, so don't expect to see one when you visit it. There is a water-powered turbine under the back porch. You can also visit the remains of Welch Hospital at the park, which operated from 1913 to 1940 and was built near Welch Spring, which was believed to have healing powers. The doctor who bought the property also believed that the cool, pollen-free air emanating from a nearby cave would be beneficial for those suffering from asthma, emphysema, and tuberculosis, or consumption as it was known at the time. It was not a success, however. The ruins are best reached by canoe, as it is located along the upper current. This beautiful country has much more to explore, such as Steagall Mountain, Rogers Creek, Prairie Hollow Gorge, to name a few. So check it out. Are you a legendary stone skipper or skimmer? Can you prove it? Competitions are held around the world. They are so intense that contestants have been known to illegally import stones. The Welsh Open Stone Skimming Championships were held last weekend, with competing ages beginning at age 6. Those 60 and over were entered in the Old Tusser category. In July, Mackinac Island, Michigan's stone skipping and gerplunking contest, hosts the oldest in the United States. And the World Stone Skimming Championships take place on Easedale Island in Scotland in September. Do something different. If you're planning a visit to San Francisco, go on Twitter and hashtag #HiddenCache. A generous Samaritan is hiding $100 bills around the city and planting clues on Twitter. Good luck!